So welcome to the first in this series of explorations of the song of the jewel mirror samadhi. This poem attributed to our ancestor Dongshan in the 800s in China, where he lived, still passed down to Japan in Dongshan's lineage. In Japan, usually chanted every day in the Zen monastery, this poem. And we chant every week here, too. Did you chant this before class?
Yes.
Did you mirror samadhi? It's nice to chant the text to kind of get used to it, kind of learn it and hear these images over and over, and they start to reveal their meaning more and more. So a little bit about Dongshan, the supposed author. I say supposed because even in the record of Dongshan, which was written down some centuries after Dongshan lived, it says that Dongshan says, "Now I pass to you, Saoshan, my disciple, this song of the jewel mirror samadhi, which I received from my teacher Yunyan." So that it's not so clear whether he received that poem or he received the jewel mirror samadhi understanding, and then he wrote the poem. And then it's sometimes attributed to Yunju's teacher, Yaoshan, maybe also wrote it, Dongshan's Dharma grandfather. And then modern scholars say actually the style of this poem is from much later times. It probably wasn't any of them. It actually didn't appear in the records, the lamp records of Zen stories, till like, I think the 1100s or something. So it may have come much later. But there's some implication that it was kind of like a secret teaching. So it may have just not been circulating in the world for several centuries. It may have been written earlier. Anyway, the origins of this are lost in the mists of obscurity, but doesn't really matter that much because it's just the teaching of suchness. But it's commonly attributed to Dongshan, and it's definitely associated with the Sao Dong lineage, in Japanese Soto. I think most of you probably heard that Soto Zen comes from these two teachers. One is Tozan, or Dongshan, is the attributed author here. And sometimes the So is attributed to Sozan, his disciple, but that lineage died out very quickly, the Sozan lineage. So, but the one that continued up to today, to this temple, we still call Soto Zen, and the So comes before To. So one understanding of this would be that the So, or in Chinese Sao, comes from the sixth ancestor who taught at Sao Chi. That was the name of the place he taught. So it's like the lineage that's conveyed by the sixth ancestor's teaching and Dongshan's teaching. They lived a few generations apart. So Dongshan's a very important ancestor for us. He's kind of defined this style of our practice in some ways. And I think when you read these collections of the Chinese ancestors from the so-called Golden Age of Tang Dynasty China, Dongshan's record is very strange compared to Lin Ji's record and Yun Men's record. I mean, they're all Zen has this kind of strange style, right? But Lin Ji, in some ways, was more straightforward and maybe kind of abrupt and to the point. Dungshan is maybe more kind of subtle style, and you know, his whole, we have this in English, the record of Dungshan, which not so long that you can read, and almost all the stories, you kind of come away feeling like I have to contemplate this more. There, you know, there are all these pointers, but it's like, very unusual style, very subtle style, Dungshan. And this dual mirror samadhi is one example. Dungshan, one of the early stories we have about him, maybe you heard this story, is when he was just a young boy, he heard somebody reciting the Heart Sutra. And when it got to the point of no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, young Dungshan said, oh, wait a second, stop. This was like maybe his teacher trying to teach it to him. He said, well, but I have eyes and ears and nose and tongue and body and mind. Why does the sutra say there isn't any? And his teacher said something like, I'm sorry, I can't be your teacher. This is too deep a question. You have to really investigate Zen to understand this. So he went on to do that. But I think this story is telling, shows us about Dungshan's personality, because he started questioning, investigating things from an early age. Didn't want to just say, well, that's what the sutra says. Don't worry about what it means. He wanted to know. But also this is question of this relationship between no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, and eyes, ear, nose, tongue. That relationship between there isn't any and there is, or we could say the ultimate truth of no eyes, no ears, and the conventional relative truth of eyes and ears. The relationship of these two truths was like a major part of Dongshan's teaching later. We call the five ranks or five positions of the relative and ultimate was part of what Dungshan's known for. Some say that this dual mirror samadhi is a poem depicting these five positions. They're kind of hidden, woven into this poem. So that will definitely bring this out later when we get to the part about the illumination hexagram and so on. And then we'll have a whole class series this summer on these five permutations of relative and ultimate. But that story as a kid already was kind of exploring that, yeah? Or wondering about that. So then we have this song of the dual mirror samadhi. As you know, quite obscure images, strange images, so we can unpack this a little in class. And as far as commentaries, there's only one kind of book commentary that I know of on the dual mirror samadhi called The Infinite Mirror by Chinese teacher Shen Yan, and who holds the Linji and Cao Dong lineages from China, and then also went and practiced in Japan for a while. So it's a commentary on both the merging of difference and unity and the song of the dual mirror samadhi. And, you know, it's pretty basic, but really nice. I like his commentary. It's called The Infinite Mirror. These two poems often kind of go together. The dual mirror samadhi sometimes said to be kind of like a commentary a few generations later on the merging of difference and unity. And they're very similar in many ways. They almost follow the same structure. They both talk about this intimate transmission at the beginning and so on. So it looks like this was somewhat based on that earlier poem. And in modern Japan, at morning service, they're often chanted together. like merging of difference and unity, followed by dual mirror samadhi, or alternating days, those two. And the other resource for study is this huge collection of notes, basically by Charlie Pokorny. You may know him from Zen, San Francisco Zen Center. He just, you know, he was studying this one time, and this is how his mind works.
Is that the one that's online?
It is online.
Because I know I was Googling this, and I came upon this like massive document.
Yeah, there you go.
It's printed out.
It's like 150 pages.
Yeah, okay.
So I guess if you just search Google, it's up there. Anyway, this is, I think, not required to print out, but if you want, it's less of a book and more like a huge collection of footnotes. So, and it's very thorough. In small print, it starts with the Chinese characters with a bunch of translations for each character. This one, I don't know if anybody looks into Chinese. We might talk about some of the characters, so I put them on here quite small, but there they are. This has bigger versions in it, and it has about 15 different translations of the poem, all kind of line by line comparison, and then it has in each section everything that Charlie could find about these particular images and terms, and really some really interesting stuff. There's the babe in the world. His baby, Baba Wawa. And then when we get into the five ranks part, especially for this summer, I think this is maybe the definitive collection. Like maybe half. Yeah, it looks like about half of this book is just on the five positions, and all these things with the I Ching hexagrams and colored circles of black and white. It's quite complex. When we get to that. So, those two resources. But also you can just read the poem and maybe even memorize it. So we start with the title, Song of the Dual Mirror Samadhi. In Japanese, Hokyo Zamai. They don't say... they don't have the song in modern Japanese Soto Zen. They just say Hokyo Zamai, which just means dual mirror samadhi. So some versions in the Chinese text call it a song. The jewel or precious mirror samadhi, jewel. Jewel or precious.
Hokyo is jewel?
Hokyo, yeah. Hokyo.
That's in our temple name?
No, a different jewel.
Oh.
Yeah. This is more like the three treasures.
Oh.
The three jewels. Mm-hmm. So treasure mirror samadhi, you could say. Mm-hmm. Rare. Valuable. Are all implied. The rare, valuable mirror, samadhi, and zamai is the Japanese transliteration of samadhi. Samadhi is the old Indian term for meditative concentration, but literally samadhi means one-pointedness of mind and object. So when you're concentrating on an object and you become so present with it that the mind and the object that's being contemplated become like one point. You could say that's one-pointedness of mind and object. That's what we call samadhi, that sense of non-separation. In early Buddha's teachings, samadhi was, you know, important in the Pali Canon and so on. It seems more as like a meditative concentration that you develop in order to develop wisdom. But part of the particular style of Zen is that this samadhi and prajna, or wisdom, became kind of like merged. They kind of started noticing, if samadhi is actually one-pointedness of mind, isn't that what wisdom is actually talking about? Is this non-separation of subject and object? Isn't that what prajna ultimately is? Prajna paramita is like the realization of non-duality. So at some point, it looks like in China, somebody kind of like started exploring, well, wait, maybe the samadhi is the realization right there. Maybe one of them who first brought this out was the sixth ancestor, where in the Platform Sutra he talks about, please don't say that samadhi and prajna are two different things. They're not separate. When he's talking about zazen, it's a wonderful section in the Platform Sutra. So thereafter, it might have kind of started with the sixth ancestor. Then there were people were talking about all these different samadhis, but not so much like particular kinds of concentration to lead to some understanding, but these different types of samadhi were like Buddha's wisdom with all these different poetic names, like the jewel mirror samadhi, the ocean seal samadhi, the limitless meanings samadhi. These actually came from other Mahayana sutras as well. So we could also translate awareness. Song of the precious, rare mirror awareness.
Instead of samadhi.
It's a kind of a loose translation of samadhi, but the nice thing about saying awareness is that samadhi sounds like this kind of like technical Buddhist practice that we have to like develop and perfect over a long time. You know, sometimes maybe implies that, but I like to think of the dual mirror awareness as more like it's the awareness that we already have always here. And in fact, parenthetically, even in these early teachings, like Abhidharma teachings of Buddhism, samadhi has this kind of meaning too. Like in Abhidharma, there's 5, sometimes 10 mental factors associated with every mind. Every experience of mind has these 5 mental factors, like contact. In order to have an experience, you have to contact an object. And feeling, there's some subtle feeling with every mental experience. One of those 5 factors that comes with every mental experience is samadhi in early Abhidharma. So that kind of already opens it up and makes it suspicious. Well, if it's this concentrated meditation that you have to develop, it's also something that's here with every single mind moment. In other words, there is a kind of, we could say, a kind of concentration on what's happening, even when we're totally distracted. For each moment we're distracted, we're actually concentrated on the object of distraction. I mean, one way to look at it.
That's generous.
You know, it's just the Abhidharma people wanted to cover all the bases, you know, and say, actually there is some momentary samadhi there. It's maybe not so helpful if we're totally distracted, but it's there.
Samadhi of distraction.
Yeah, something like that. Or we could see it as mind and object really are always one point. It's just that they seem to be divided into subject and object. So samadhi was used as a meditative concentration, and it was also used as a quality of every experience in the early teachings. And I think we could see that as in Zen practice. There's a practice you can sit down and do in the Zendo, but also that mind that you're cultivating in Zazen is always here. And we've already been talking about the jewel mirror for a month or so now. I think very, very simple. We could look at it complex, and it sounds like this poem is very complex, but maybe just a very intricate and subtle way of talking about something very simple. Almost like it's so simple we can barely stand to open to it, because as humans we like complexity. But if we say it's this awareness that's always with us, that's just it's just open and shining all the time. It's never actually turned off. It's never blocked. It just we're just not paying attention to it, because we're so caught up in the objects of experience, we forget that the awareness that's aware of them. So that's why in this last session we were talking about the practice of turning the light around, shining back. This is a little bit like just resting back into the mirror awareness that's always here. So today I was even thinking turning the light and shining back is a little problematic too, because it sounds like this really difficult thing. That, like, how do you do that? Because you shine back and you can't quite see what's there, but we're trying to shine it on this object of awareness, but it's not an object. So maybe it can be misleading, because it can become this difficult, tricky thing to do. Whereas it's more like if we just really relax in the present and notice that we're just aware of what's happening, and we're not so caught up in the objects and stories out there that we usually are, then we're starting to just rest in the mirror, the natural mirror that's always here. Yes?
Is there another translation for the word mirror?
No, I don't think so. I think that's the one that's pretty straightforward. Yeah. Here it says lens or glass. Or glasses. So I guess that's interesting. Yeah. Maybe that's a more rare meaning. I think it's almost always translated as mirror. But one translation creatively tries to translate samadhi and in terms of this mirror as the song of focusing the precious mirror. So you could say if it's like a lens, focusing this rare lens.
Well, they're like parabolic mirrors. They use them to receive things from space. And the shape of it ends up focusing all the information.
Interesting. I could play with that image. One point, but this one point, sometimes we think of samadhi as like we have to focus very concentratedly on one point, like the breath, right, as it's like coming in and out of the nostrils. Sometimes samadhi is taught like this, especially in like the Theravada tradition. But these Mahayana samadhis are like very wide, broad. They're not like this very narrow focus. They're like very all-inclusive. And I think of the precious mirror like this, is it's like it's equally reflecting everything, and it's clearly reflecting without distortion, but it's not like blocking out all the peripheral vision to focus on this one point. It's more like opening so peripherally that it includes like everything in all dimensions at once. Very, very wide instead of very, very narrow. And you could say that very wide, wide universal awareness is one point. One-pointed awareness, the one point of the universe. Funny way of talking, but...
No distraction from that place.
Yeah, no distraction from that place. And sometimes we can see, if we can catch that the distractions are part of that so-called place, non-place, then they're included too. But if we don't notice that, and we think the distractions are not it, then... that's what's called distraction. and we feel constricted, right? So if we can include everything, including distractions, in this open, relaxed, kind of spacious awareness, then it's almost like there can be no distractions. As soon as we focus on, get caught by one of them, then that's a so-called distraction. Like the precious mirror, however big or small it is, of course it has no size or location, but it contains the whole universe, you know, like a drop of water. Yeah.
Not to be too little, but there's the backing of the traditional mirror. If we're not thinking of a parabolic mirror, we're thinking of the mirror's backing, which is what allows that reflexivity and wholeness. What could the backing be?
Well, it was one time recently we were talking about the mirror, because I think it's just a great image to play with in various ways. Picturing where the mirror is, it's just a metaphor, right?
Mm-hmm.
But picturing it where in relation to you. What's your relationship to the mirror? Is it behind you? Is it like a plane from your eyes? Is it in front of you like this? And somebody brought up, what about a one-way mirror? It's kind of like there's a backing on one side, like in a jail, right? So people can on one side they can see through, and on the other side it's just a mirror. And I said, they said, well, who's on what side of the one-way mirror? And I thought, well, maybe like Buddha is on the side of the jail keeper, watching through the mirror, seeing everybody. And when we're looking at Buddha, all we see is ourselves in the mirror. Yeah, Buddha's the backing, you could say. That's nice. Buddha's the backing, whether or not it's a one-way mirror. Yeah. And by Buddha, we mean awakened awareness, actually. Right?
Okay.
Yes.
One-way mirrors looked like 1,200 years ago. I'm sure it was not. I have a feeling it was not plastic.
Yeah.
Silver on the back.
I think they were metal in old China. Yeah, and probably not as clear as our modern mirrors. You can't make metal that reflective, and they didn't have chrome tinting and all that. So, yeah. But still, supposedly they had mirrors they used. And they had reflective surfaces on the water, which Dongshan had his great awakening, seeing his reflection in the water, and then went on to write this mirror samadhi. So this reflection effect is part of Dongshan's life, too. We'll get more into that story.
Mm-hmm. So this mirror is just... non-discriminatory receptivity.
Yeah.
And then another part of our mind picks and chooses images and names and evaluates.
Yeah. So, as we've been talking about it, that's, I think, a nice definition. Non-descriptive receptivity. That's what a mirror does, right? It doesn't discriminate among images. Like we have a story, an old Zen story, you know, when a foreigner comes, it reflects a foreigner. When a native comes, it reflects a native, which is really about like non-discrimination in the way we think of maybe even racial discrimination, right, in that story. It equally reflects whatever is placed before it without discrimination, and it receives the image without distortion. It just reflects it clearly back, and also the receptivity is it's not bothered. Like it doesn't, like a really ugly image comes and it doesn't really care, a really beautiful image, it doesn't care. It just equally receives very graciously, and it doesn't block. It doesn't reject images, and it doesn't grasp images. Just when something is placed before it, it just reflects. So it's a beautiful, straightforward image for the mind of Zazen. So I really think whatever we do with this poem, I think to bring into your Zazen practice, especially if you feel like you're like really distracted and really caught up in stuff and really discriminating and resisting and attaching, to just say, mirror. Be the mirror. I wouldn't say make your mind like a mirror, because that implies that you have to like create it. This, another name for the mirror is Buddha nature. So we talked a lot last year about Buddha nature is something that you don't make. It's always with us, and it's always clearly aware and empty of being able to get a hold of it. So mirror is a nice image for that too. Great meditation practice. And then, as Patrick said, then we have these discriminating thoughts. So you say, well, if it's always with us, well, how could it be with us when we're having the discriminating thoughts? They can be simultaneous, right? It's like, just like a mirror, it's equally reflecting all these images, but it doesn't like turn off the images. Like there's native people and foreigners, there's beautiful and ugly, all of it's being reflected at the same time as there's no grasping and rejecting. Right? So it's like everything's appearing, including so-called crazy thoughts and distractions and all kinds of mental turmoil at the same time as it's being reflected. So this is definitely a principle of our Zazen. We don't have to like turn off all distracted thoughts, eliminate all conceptual thinking. It's virtually impossible to do. It's that we see how it's reflected in the mirror. And the calmer we are, the easier it is to start to see if there are just little waves in this vast still lake. It's easier to see how they're part of the still lake. If it's a huge storm and it's just like, 10-foot surf, it's going to be really hard. Still possible, you know. In principle, it's still always just the water, but it's very difficult, as we know, right? So therefore we have conventionally this practice of sit in the present, let go of the past and the future, and rest in this present awake awareness. And then we can start, the more we get used to that, the more we start to see how, oh, stuff can come up on the surface of the mirror, and the mirror, it's okay, the mirror doesn't mind.
What's your impression of resting in samadhi and then spontaneously starting to dance?
My impression.
What's your impression? How would that? How does that work for you?
Well, we might talk about this when we get to the wooden man singing and the stone woman getting up to dance, right? But in terms of the discussion right now, we could just say the mirror is like the resting, and the images on it are like the dance. And the more they're integrated, the more the dance can be on the mirror. We see that the dance is happening on the surface of the mirror, and it's not sticking to the mirror. Then the dance can be more and more free-flowing and spontaneous, and there's less thoughts of like, I hope this dance is okay. I might forget the step or something, then we're kind of like, that becomes less mirror-like, and now we're sort of grasping or rejecting the dance steps.
To pursue it one step, what would be the impulse to stop being at rest and move into dance?
You could say that the dance is like taking place on the surface of this resting mirror, like they're both integrated. In fact, that's these images that are going to come up soon.
Between dancing and resting.
What's the difference?
I mean, that's just me.
It's not so much that you, I guess if we get fixated on the like on the mirror not reflecting anything and just being total stillness, that would be like kind of resisting the dance, right? Yeah. But if the mirror is really open, it's very still, but it also it's receptive. So if there's an impulse to dance, that dance impulse is reflected, and then the dance starts happening. So I think it's not so much that you stop resting, I guess is what I would say, in order to really dance freely. The free dance, however vigorous and exerting it is happening on this surface of ease and rest. How about that?
Okay.
Song of the Jewel Mirror, awareness.
The mirror just reflects whatever goes on.
Yeah.
But I think the human animal is pattern seeking and will just lock on to the lower left corner and give it all kinds of meaning.
Yes.
And implications and the story around it.
Yeah.
So.
We fixate on one corner of the mirror, huh? How to keep the. Yes, and we have to concentrate on certain tasks. We focus here, but this awareness would be like also keeping this peripheral awareness open to the rest of it. Maybe even it's almost like it's just open. The peripheral awareness is open, but it's not functioning so much because we're functioning over here, but it's ready to. So if somebody over here, like I'm reading this and somebody says, hey, then I can go. Because it's still open. But if I really focus here, somebody's saying, hey, Gokyo. And I don't even notice. So again, that's like the zazen, that we may be like following our breath in zazen, but we're also opening to like there's the birds singing outside. We don't block that out. At the same time, we're still on the breath. And this awareness, also talked about in here, if your practice is following breath or counting breath, that's not contradictory to this type of mirror samadhi. It's more like you can be following the breath, but you and the breath are both being reflected in the mirror. Like there's this larger awareness, not only of the breath, but the one who is aware of the breath. So another kind of classic Zen technique, you could say, of like becoming more familiar and intimate with the mirror is like these who questions. Like you're like following the breath and you're kind of quite settled and concentrated on the breath, and then ask, well, who is following the breath actually? Who is this? Or whatever you're doing, you know, you can ask, who is actually doing this? And that's the same thing of like turning back the awareness of like, well, who is this? Well, me. Well, no, but who's me? Well, actually, we find there's just this awareness. Awareness is following the breath, right? And you could say that's the mirror. So you can be following the breath, focus on the breath, but also keep in mind the one who's following the breath, which is the mirror. And that you can do these things simultaneously, just like you can be like have a thought stream going and still be aware of the awareness behind it. But again, when training in this, it's as we know, it's helpful to have places like a zendo where it's pretty quiet, and we have a time where we can just stop what we're doing and be here, because it's very hard, you know, when things are really chaotic, to be in touch with the mirror. But the more we get in touch with it when things are calm, the more we can maybe start to access it when things aren't so calm. I think that's why we practice like this. Otherwise, we'd have to just like never leave the zendo. That wouldn't be so useful.
My experience of concentration is not the eliminating of everything except the smallest point. It's kind of, while looking at the point, it's an expansion of the horizon.
so everything has a common center point.
Mm-hmm.
But I find the more I'm able to do that, the more I can associate what I'm experiencing with the word equanimity.
Yeah. Everything has its place in the midst of the whole.
Right. So if I have this horizon of being accepting of all that's occurring, I can actually move the center point and pay full attention without actually being distracted by anything. Mm-hmm. Because everything is present.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it actually makes me more vigilant in a sense. If there is something with constant bearing and decreasing range coming at me, I can move. It was a bus. Mm-hmm. But I could see it even though I was concentrating on this here. So
yeah.
And I don't have to have an attitude about being disturbed. So for me, concentration is increasing the scope of the horizon to include as much as is coming in, but at the same time paying attention to what's necessary to be appropriate at the moment.
Maybe we could say concentric circles.
Exactly.
Moving
precisely.
Out and out like ripples.
As opposed to getting eccentric, like I got this here, then I got that there, and I'm bubble, bubble, bubble.
Eccentric, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Have you heard the teaching of thusness has been intimately communicated by Buddhas and ancestors? Now you have it, so keep it well. I don't know if this is intentional or not. Maybe, probably is to some extent. I don't know if any of the commentaries mention this. Maybe they do. That basically all Buddhist sutras start, the early ones and the Mahayana ones start, thus have I heard, and this is like evam in Sanskrit and Pali is the thus. It's different than, it's a more colloquial like thus have I heard, as opposed to like I have heard thusness, you know. The word English word has that sense too. It's often thus have I heard. But in Chinese, the first two characters, the way they translate that, the first two characters of every sutra are these first two characters. So it's kind of neat. It's like making it a sutra. And literally, so those characters mean like this. Nyoze. Like this. And that's just the way they translate thus. But it's also this technical term, ta-ta-ta, which means thusness or suchness, which is
T-A-T-H-A.
T-A-T-H-A-T-A. Ta-ta-ta.
T-A-T-H-A-T-A.
Ta-ta-ta. Because ta-ta means thus, and if you put a ta on the end, it's thusness.
Uh-huh.
Like shunya means empty, and shunyata means emptiness. So ta-ta-ta, ta-ta-ta means suchness or thusness. And the tathagata is the one who's gone to suchness, or come from suchness, or comes thus, the thus come one. Tathagata. Whether it's Tathagata or Tathagata, it could be heard as thus come or thus gone. But a little bit like in English, to translate thus, we would say, you know, this watch is such as it is. So to say like this, this watch is like this. That's how they do it in Chinese. So literally it means like this. Is the used for both tata ta and also for evam to open the sutra. Thus have I heard. So thus, the dharma of thusness has been intimately communicated or entrusted. This is probably the most common translation. It could be transmitted. It's not the same character that's used for like transmission of light and so on. In trust. So the Dharma of suchness or thusness has been intimately entrusted or communicated by Buddhas and ancestors. Now you have it. So keep it or guard it well, protect it well. Now we could say the whole rest of the poem is about this teaching of suchness, which is another name for the dual mirror. Dual mirror is suchness. It's empty. Suchness is often a synonym for emptiness, but it has a little more positive connotation, right? Just in English, emptiness is the negation aspect. Suchness means it's empty of any graspability, but it's a little more positive. So it's like this emptiness, but it's also aware. So suchness is the empty awareness called the jewel, the precious mirror. And it's been intimately communicated or entrusted. You can't really transmit thusness, right? And can you even communicate it? Well, I think this is Dongshan's attempt at communicating it. And you can entrust the care of it. You can entrust an understanding of it. And that's what it seems like these ancestors are doing. And now you have it, so we can hear this is transmission, secret transmission poem that Yunyan is giving to Dongshan. Now you have it, but here's the teaching for everybody, and now it's chanted everywhere. You have it. Everybody has it. So keep it well. That's, I think, very nice. These two sides of you already have it. You can't get rid of it. You can't actually lose it. It's impossible. You can't destroy it. You could even go so far as to say even when you die, it doesn't go anywhere. You have it. And keep it well. Preserve it well. Or protect. It's like the character that's used for like Dharma protectors. Protect it, guard it, keep it well. So why would you need to, or how would you protect something that you already have?
Emptiness can be seen as vacuum. However, what I hear here is that it's actually kind of assertive presence.
Yeah, presence.
Sort of presence, and how would you protect it? By meeting it.
Meeting it or being it?
Being it.
Mm-hmm. Because we had this discussion about meeting the other day, right? It's impossible to actually meet anyone or anything truly, because that implies that there's somebody outside you to meet. So, but you can. You can be it, and you can, accord with it.
Be intimate with it.
Intimate with it. Mm-hmm. You can be the intimacy of it. Mm. Yeah. A very funny thing. I think this, in a way, you could say this is like the heart of our Zen practices. We already have it. There's nothing to get, but we have to like diligently take care of it. Protect it and maintain it.
I also think there's an aspect of not disparaging that comes up for me, you know, because we say we have it, but then we don't always behave in accord with awareness or something.
So not disparaging the it?
Well, like not
mirror?
Disparaging the triple treasure being aware of the precepts.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, there's that side to too.
Yeah,
the part that speaks to our rough human aspect.
Yeah, you could say disparaging the triple treasure would be like, I don't care about this jewel mirror. I'm just gonna like act on this like self-centered impulse and tell that person what I really think. It's kind of like you could say disparaging the treasure of Buddha, the treasure mirror.
I mean, any of the triple treasures, mm-hmm. like disparaging Buddha in our own action, you know, how we live our lives.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you could say that the Bodhisattva precepts are like the are the way to protect and maintain the mirror awareness. Yeah, I think
whenever
so.
Whenever I've heard this line, I always think of that part.
Yeah, I think that
for some reason,
because that's what they are. They're like, they're
keep
about
it
protecting.
Well, you know, honor it, protect mm-hmm. it.
You could always say like that's the conventional world. The mirror reflects total evil indiscriminately with total beneficence. But the way to protect that non-discrimination is to avoid all evil, actually, and accord with all beings, with the precepts.
Mm-hmm. Intimate responsibility, intimate emptiness is now your responsibility.
Or the intimacy of emptiness is your responsibility. Because emptiness, no one even has to be responsible for, because it's empty of having to do anything. But the intimacy of the emptiness, we're responsible for, and we take care of by being that intimacy.
The now.
Now.
Interests me, just in terms of. Yeah. Say now you have it as if it's been taught to you,
mm-hmm.
or the one that I think we're accepting is, which is now you have it,
mm-hmm.
so treasure it,
mm-hmm.
which is more like a whatever the term for that type of a word,
like a command almost.
Yeah, it's now you have it.
Mm-hmm.
We all have it.
Yeah.
So because it doesn't make sense to me to hear now you have it as if it's been transmitted to you through some, because he's about to give it to us.
Mm-hmm.
Hasn't done it yet. So it's just like,
well, he's about to give a description, but we already have it. But
we have it.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't have the description. We don't have the transmission.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think now you could say is a totally key word. And you could also hear it as just, it's a moment to moment. Like, it's not like this thing you have when you go to Zazen, or this thing that you remember when you're studying the text. It's now, 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 now you have it, now you have it. It's always present. So now is a wonderful word in there. Thank you for illumining it. Yeah. Now you have it, now you have it, now you have it.
You have to think of cultivation. Keeping it well to cultivate. Mm.
Mm-hmm. And how do you cultivate a mirror? You cultivate a field by keeping the soil from getting too hardened. You have to keep the soil moist and soft, with some pockets for planting seeds so that cantaloupes grow well.
identifying that it's causes and conditions to cultivate.
Yeah. It's in the realm, the caring for, protecting and maintaining is in the realm of causes and conditions. Yeah. Whereas in a way we could say the mirror itself is free of all causes and conditions. Because if the mirror was conditioned, if you take away the conditions, it would disappear, but it never arose and it never disappears. So in that way it's unconditioned, but the way we take care of it is in the realm of creating positive conditions for this intimacy with the mirror,
I was going to say maybe cultivate the cleanliness of the mirror by keeping dust off.
Mm. Yeah, so we have these classic Zen poems about dusty mirrors, like the one, like the story of these poems of these students of the fifth ancestor, and one wrote the story about the body is the bright mirror stand. This body is, holds this inconceivable precious mirror awareness. The body is the bright mirror stand. Does anybody remember?
The mirror is the mind.
The tree.
Oh yeah. Oh, yeah.
But the point being that you have to constantly clean the mirror to keep the dust free, polish the mirror to keep the dust from blocking this awareness, and then workman Lu, who would become the sixth ancestor, kind of rewrote the poem and said, the mirror has no stand, actually, and awakening has no tree. Where is there any place for dust to land? It's kind of like, so I think these two sides work together. Sometimes you would say, well, that was the better poem, but I think both poems work together. It's like there's the practice of actually letting go of thought. It's like wiping the mirror clean.
You read the poem?
Yeah, just to finish this image of like letting go of thought is like wiping the mirror clean, and then we get really, really settled. We see that even when thought's there, it doesn't actually, it's not really there on the mirror. Sure, how does the poem go?
Okay, so the poem is written by the student. It says, the body is a Bodhi tree.
The body is a Bodhi tree.
The mind, the standing mirror bright, at all times polishes diligently, and let no dust alight. And then Wei Neng's response was, Bodhi is fundamentally without any tree. The bright mirror is also not a stand. Fundamentally, there is not a single thing. Where could any dust be attracted or land?
Yeah. A light.
Form and emptiness.
Mm-hmm.
Absolute and relative.
Mm. The cleaning is like the form.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we, I think if you go too far and say, there's no dust to bother the mirror, if we can really see that really clearly, then that's the case. But we can't just say, it's no real dust here, but I actually feel totally miserable and I really believe it. It's like, let's let go. Let's actually cultivate the practice of letting go of these thoughts and emotions. And again, it's kind of like we start with that, I think, and then we get settled enough, and then we can start to see that, the little ones that come up are actually, we see that they're not really disturbing the mirror.
When we fixate on ideas or definitions of objects, we're turning the mirror into a kind of coffee table where it's not a mirror anymore. We're abusing it in this way. So taking care of the mirror is allowing it to reflect reality as it is without the burden of carrying our glasses and our ashtrays and things like this.
Mm. And more and more coming from being the mirror, kind of like living from the perspective of the mirror, while still operating in the world. It's a different perspective. It's like the myriad things coming forth and confirming us as reflections in the mirror, rather than like bringing the self, forget the mirror, just bring the self forward and confirm things from our side. The mirror is that receptivity of letting the myriad things come forth and just be reflected. So, also about suchness and thusness. In the Zen tradition, we have some great stories about suchness, like that first case in the Book of Serenity, the Buddha sits up on the seat and says, and says nothing. Buddha sits up on the seat, and Manjushri strikes the block and says, clearly observe, the Dharma of the King of Dharma is thus, or is like this. It's the same term, is such or thus. And then the Buddha gets down from the seat and leaves. So that's the in the book of Serenity is kind of in the Dongshan lineage. It's a Dongshan lineage collection of koans. So it starts with this clearly observe the Buddha's Dharma. The Buddha's Dharma is thus, and he has to say that because the Buddha can't say anything. We call that Manjushri's leaking. He has to say a little bit. So it's a lot about thusness is free from all concepts and words, which this poem, in a lot of words, does talk about. The other classic story about thus or such is Nanyue comes to the sixth ancestor. Yeah, and the ancestor says, where are you coming from? And he says, Mount Song. And ancestor says, what is it that thus comes? What is coming thus? What is the thusness of your coming here? What is the suchness before me right now? And Nanyue couldn't answer. And one story says he worked on this for 8 years. What is it that thus comes? What is it that's coming and going as suchness, or from suchness, or into suchness? How do these reflections interact with this empty mirror? And finally, after 8 years, he comes back and says, okay, I can respond now. The answer says, what is it that thus comes? And Nanyue says, to say it's this misses the mark. Took him 8 years to say that, to say it's this misses the mark. What is it that thus comes? To say it's this or that or anything. To say anything about suchness misses the mark. The meaning is not in the words, this poem will say. Hui Nong approves him, saying, first he says, well then, is there no practice and realization? And Nanyue says, it's not that there's no practice and realization, it's just that they can't be defiled by saying, this is practice, and that's not practice. This is realization, that's not realization. They can't be defiled like that.
But it's not that,
it's not that there's no practice and realization, though. That's too much to say. No, there's no practice and there's no realization. It's not that there's no practice and there's no realization. It's just that they can't be defiled by our ideas and words. And then Hui Nong says, this non-defilement, this way that words don't reach it, this non-defilement is what's been protected and maintained by all the Buddhas and ancestors. And then he said, I am thus, you are thus too. So that's another classic Zen story about thusness. And they both point to, like, it's the way things are, like this. Literally, nyoze, like this, but not like this. Not like any way we can say, like this. Like this, free of all our ideas. Like this, the way the mirror just receives and doesn't edit, doesn't even comment. The mirror just receives. Yes?
The word defilement has always bothered me. Could it have the sense of delimitation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what in Zen defiled means, delimited or limited.
In
by
our English translation of it, it carries other meanings.
Yeah, well, it's kind of nice that, like, they talk about purity and defilement in Zen, and it's kind of like the hidden meaning, because I think all religious traditions have these ideas about purity and defilement. So it's kind of like, we're going to use those words because we have to, because we're a religious tradition, and people will complain if we don't. But let's redefine them now, and let's say that purity just means free from all our ideas, and defilement means like grasped by our ideas. Yeah, so free of all our ideas of purity and defilement, that's purity. Defiled by ideas of defilement and purity, that's defilement.
Thank you.
In Zen.
I wish we could change the words sometimes.
Well, it's nice because when we can use them by being free of them, we can reflect them like a mirror.
Mm-hmm.
We don't say, we have to like eliminate these nasty words like evil, twisted karma. No, we can say it. We just say it in this reflective kind of way. Just maybe they left those words in there just to like test us, like see if we can use them freely.
They did.
They did, yeah. They. Those old Zen theys.
Those rascals.
Rascals.
Or we could use them with the diagonal line through them as some French philosophers did, which is allowing us to use them and also indicate that we're not subscribing to the usual usage.
But
there's something else going on.
Put that through
every word. So, we have some great stories from Dongshan about responding to things like a mirror, with the mirror awareness. Another classic one is in the Blue Cliff Record, case 43, no heat or cold, no cold or heat. You could say, this is the precious mirror awareness operating. This is Dongshan saying it in another way. So a monk asked Dongshan, when heat and cold come, how can we avoid them? When hot and cold come, how can we reject them? Get away from them. Just find some way to like be with them, because the weather is so unpredictable and so unpleasant. It's always a little too hot or a little too cold, isn't it? And when heat and cold come, how can we avoid them? Dongshan said, why don't you go where there's no cold and heat? And the monk said, where is there no cold and heat? So you might think, Santa Cruz.
Santa Cruz.
Or you might think, like, go into a really deep concentration where you don't notice like get so focused on the present that you don't notice anything that's happening, something like that. Where emptiness, right? But actually, where is there no cold and heat? Dongshan said, when it's cold, it chills you thoroughly. When it's hot, it heats you thoroughly. Or another translation is, when it's cold, the cold kills you. And when it's hot, the heat kills you. So you could even say, when it's cold, just be completely cold, completely. And when it's hot, be completely hot. I hear that as like, you're just the dual mirror, right? So when it's cold, you just reflect the cold. When it's hot, you reflect the hot.
So there's not two things. There's not you and cold.
Yeah, there's not you and cold. Yeah, no separation. But it's not that's the mirror doesn't say reject them, or let's somehow like block them out and just be like a clear mirror with nothing on it. No, the mirror is happy to play the part of a mirror, which is just reflecting cold and heat. But the cold and heat don't stick to it. Right? They are just images on the mirror. Very clear images, like it really feels cold. And yet, it's free from the cold, right in the very midst of the cold. The cold chills you right to the bone. That's how to be free. That's where, and you know, again, the story is, when cold and heat come, how can we avoid them? Why don't you go where there's no cold and heat? Mm-hmm. Where is there no cold and heat? When it's cold, you're totally cold. Hot, you're totally hot. That's where there's no cold and heat. So, very much like the jewel mirror. Yeah.
I know you understand this, but like in the Sufi story, believe in God, but tether your camel. One answer that I would find perfectly acceptable, when it's cold, put your coat on. When it's warm, take it off.
Yeah, well, we have Zen stories like great master Lin Ji. When tired, I sleep. When hungry, I eat. Fools laugh at me, but the wise one understands. So, yeah. Which is also like the jewel mirror.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, when I think the implication is like, when something's coming and you can't avoid it, just receive it fully. If you can do something, receive the doing something fully. Receive putting on the coat fully. So there's no fixed way in the dual mirror here, right there. So, you know, people, there's like ongoing, people like to take sides about like cold Zen temples. Like in Japan.
Hot water bottles.
You know. I know.
So,
like
this was really nice the other day when I didn't know the heater was broken.
Yeah, there you go. But if you're used to a certain way, then it's like we have a conceptual idea about the past. But
yes,
now you have this one, so keep this one well. A certain number. But like the place I practice, like in Japan, I think it's kind of usual that they just don't heat temples. Like it's, you know, it's around freezing, but it doesn't get down into the 20s, so you're not going to die. So, and I think it's contrary to popular opinion, my opinion is that it's not about just like trying to like be really like austere and like ascetic practice. I don't think it is. I mean, maybe some people do think it is. I think it's about just like, you're just living really simply. And, you know, and you're heating often with firewood, and there's not that much wood in Japan. And so it's like, you know, let's just be frugal. And it's kind of like environmental protection, you know. Like sometimes we you have a bath, a wood-fired bath once a week in the Japanese Zen temple, and they burn the wood, and people, and it's about like total enjoyment. It's like ecstasy. And you can stay in there like as long as you want, and in this hot tub, like really hot. So the room's all full of steam. And it's like, okay, we'll do it once a week. And then, but we don't have enough wood to do it every day. And to heat these huge halls, it's like you couldn't, you know, it would just be ridiculous. So we'll just be cold, and when it's hot, you can't air condition this huge hall, so you just be hot. And when it's spring and fall in the middle, so sweet, so nice. But and I asked people when I got there, I'm like, is this like extreme like ascetic practice? Like, what about the middle way? And like that, Roshi doesn't see it that way. He's just like, and I think the standard thing was, no, it's just when it's winter, you just experience winter really fully, and you just taste the flavor of winter. And actually, when you go through the cycle, there is something really sweet. Like, you really know you're in winter if it's not heated. And when it's summer, you really know it's summer. And when spring comes, it's like so totally beautiful. And another story is, he would in the Zendo, we leave the windows open. Maybe that's going too far. When it's snowing and the snow would be coming through, and I'd be sitting there. I was sitting next to the window, and I would because I was right there. And the wind and the snow on the zabuton, and so I'm just it's just somebody probably forgot to leave the window. So I just very very quietly just slide it just a little bit, and the head monk across the hall. Don't adjust the windows, you know. And Roshi would be sitting in there too. And at one point he said, we just in this Zendo we welcome everyone and everything. And that was his spirit, is total welcome. It's snowing, so we'll welcome the snow and sit with the snow. And
well, I feel like I know it's winter when I'm wrapping myself in a blanket. And I'm pretty sure that every one of those monks has a blanket. So it's not about, they try to live simply. Mm-hmm. It's they're kind of really not thinking a real camper.
People wear 10 layers. I mean, you can wear as much as you want, and people would. And you just never take off for 3 months. It's 10 layers.
So why, if it's not that today, why aren't they wrapping themselves in their blankets?
That's what I'm saying. You do stay pretty warm, actually.
Okay.
You do. Yeah, you try to stay as warm as you can, given the... And then the formality of the Zendo, if you're wearing okesa and stuff, you can't actually put a blanket because, that's just the form. But underneath your robes, basically, layers upon layers of wool things. So, yeah, no problem. And people do that. Some people do these puffy puffballs.
And you can't ever wear a hat.
Well, yeah, there's also... It's funny because, they have these customs, and you could say, well, couldn't they bypass the customs? Isn't it kind of silly to keep the custom of a shaved head with no hat when it's below freezing? But that's just, I don't know, maybe we could see that as just part of the fun of the game. It's yeah, we'll do it. And certain ceremonies, you wear these, these white besu or tabi, these socks. And it's so nice when you get those certain special ceremonies because your feet are finally warm, but you generally have to go barefoot. So it's ceremony time. But then for regular service, you just, and your feet are cold again. It's not unbearable. Also, it's and people had all kinds of ways of working with it. You try not, as it's starting to get fall and starting to get colder, they say, don't add all your layers at once. Because if you gradually, as it's getting colder, add more layers. Because if you add them all at once, it's just going to get colder and colder, and you've reached your limit. But if your body actually adjusts, and I found this, your body really does adjust to the temperature in these ways that we don't get to experience so much when we're air conditioning our air a lot. It's a fine line. You have to be careful with these things. I think it's true. It's really cool because it's so austere. We're so tough. Then we've lost it, right? Then we're identifying with fixating on it. But in as a kind of environmental efficiency, which I think these temples are pretty good models of low impact on the environment. In many ways, using all the leftovers as far as you can go, just patching your robes over and over. And I think that's part of the Zen spirit. Dogen really honored this, just simplify. Just what's needed, but also don't be ridiculous. It's if your robe is just totally shredded, you're going too far, just start with a new one and you patch it till it becomes ridiculous and then stop. And Dogen actually says you should sit in a cool place in summer and a warm place in winter in his Zazen instructions. So the interpretation of that in Japan seems to be like, well, like sometimes they'll have like a little hibachi sort of like a little coal burner or something, and then they kind of like take the edge off and you can kind of like warm your hands and like, you know, there's some whatever seems appropriate to the community at the time, I think. And when the temperature is just right and like neither too hot nor too cold, be killed by that. You know, just be that perfect temperature completely. So like, I wonder how long this will last before it gets cold again. So, the jewel mirror for the day. So this is an introduction to it. And you can keep it well.
Keep it well. Now.
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 Now you have it.
Now.
I think one of the things about Zen is there's always this dialectic of you have it, there's really nothing to do, there's really nothing to attain, this awareness is impossible to avoid, and how do we really take care of it? We dedicate any positive energy arising from this discussion to all living beings. May they fully take care of their precious mirror. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Millions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to be